Hi, so I'm here with Professor Bas Bloom at Nijmegen. Always a difficult word to pronounce for foreigners, but hi, hi, Dr. Bloom. Could you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. My name is Bas Bloom. I'm a professor of movement disorder neurology. I work at the Radboud University Medical Center in, this is the correct pronunciation, Nijmegen. They say Dutch is a disease of the throat, and Nijmegen is an excellent word to demonstrate this. I'm the medical director and founder of the Parkinson Center. It's a center of excellence at my university. I'm also the co-founder of the Dutch Parkinson Net, and we may talk about that a little bit later.
Yes, we'll definitely get into those things. But the first thing I wanted to talk about was your recent paper that forecasts a global Parkinson's pandemic with a doubling of people with Parkinson's over the next 2 decades. Do you believe that this is inevitable? And what, if anything, needs to be done to prevent this from happening?
Yeah, so first of all, the results were not my own results. It's an extrapolation based on previous studies and a recent paper that came out in The Lancet from the Global Burden of Disease. The Global Burden of Disease is basically an international survey, not specifically focused on Parkinson's at all. They're just surveying rates of change in the incidence, the number of new cases of Parkinson patients, you know, across the board. And if you have a Parkinson interest, and if you look at the data, it's actually quite striking, you might even say, an alarming increase in number of new Parkinson patients forecasted for the next 1 or 2 decades. What we can do about it is, of course, a vexing question. There's nothing we have today to slow down, let alone arrest progression of the disease in the folks who already have it. And any of those interventions would likely also be able to prevent the disease from happening in folks at risk for future development. There's a number of things where we have high hopes. Some of them include non-pharmacological interventions, exercise and diet, promising at best, but no proof yet. And then there's, of course, exciting developments now in the field of antibodies directed against alpha-synuclein, which is the protein that's misfolding in the diseased neurons in the brain, or vaccines for against Parkinson's, which, if they prove to be effective, and that's a big if, of course, could in the long term prevent development of the disease. So currently we don't have anything. The good news for the folks out there is lots of stuff happening, and there's some decent hopes for future development.
That is good news, and hopefully one of those future developments strikes gold soon enough. The next question I wanted to ask was actually from Dr. John Stanford and Sarah Regare. Aside from raising funds and lobbying, what role do you think patients should play in setting research agendas?
I actually once gave a speech about this, and I think patients should play a role in all stages of research. So I think patients should be partners in research. So just like we tend to think of patients as partners in healthcare, we should really begin to see patients as partners in research. And just as in healthcare, it's not the patient bossing the doctor around, it's shared decision making. I see the same process for science. So it doesn't mean that patients say, you know, snap your fingers and let's do this. I think patients and scientists should co-decide about the research agenda, what should take priority over what. They should be jointly responsible for raising the money. They should be jointly responsible, once you have the money, for building the protocols. Many doctors, in their enthusiasm, or scientists, build protocols that are simply not tolerable for patients. So they should co-design the protocols. Then, of course, the patients should play a critical role in interpreting the data. What does it mean, not only scientifically, but what does it mean to the life of patients? And finally, I think this is perhaps even the most crucial phase, is the implementation of published research findings into clinical practice. And what I see happening a lot is that scientists are interested in the science, and they publish a paper, and once the paper has been published, they fly onto the next butterfly, you know, like the butterfly to the next flower, well before the previous flower has been fully exploited. So research findings should find their way to clinical practice. And in that final implementation phase, where most groups worldwide are weak, I think patients play a critical role.
Well put. Now, going back to what you mentioned before, the Parkinson's Net program, what would you say have been some of the most important lessons that you've learned from spearheading this program in the Netherlands for as long as you have? And what advice would you give to people in other countries that might be trying to implement something similar?
So first of all, we founded ParkinsonNet for a number of reasons. One is I strongly, capital letters, believe that Parkinson's is way too complex to be handled by generalists alone. I'm not saying a generalist is not important. You need a general practitioner, for example, to oversee comorbidity and conflicting advices. But when you need, when you have a complex gait problem, for example, you need an expert with deep understanding of Parkinson's and who has seen and treated a large number of patients to help you best. So ParkinsonNet is a nationwide network that consists of a limited number of people who are receive deep training in Parkinson's disease according to the latest insights, who have ongoing training each year to keep them up to speed, who attract a high caseload, and who collaborate in a multidisciplinary team, and who treat patients as their partner in healthcare. That approach in the Netherlands, and we now have four or five trials, including the latest one in The Lancet Neurology, shows that a specialized therapist who works as part of a network and adopts a patient-centered approach leads to much better care, fewer disease complications, is actually cheaper, may even save lives, and patients are happier.
Wow. Well, let's hope that's something that more countries and more people in various places of the world try to adopt. Moving on to the next project that you seem to be a part of, to me it seems almost like the evolution of Parkinson's Net. It's this new personalized Parkinson's project. Just reading about it seems like the most involved study of its kind, including molecular analysis and advanced brain imaging and wearable devices to detect a wide range of vital signs. But I guess my question is, do you worry that this project doesn't actually go far enough?
That's an interesting question. So this is an example of a very intense study where we had active involvement of patients, the Dutch Parkinson Patient Foundation, to think with us whether it was not too hefty. Because what we're doing is patients are giving blood, genetic materials, stools, a lumbar puncture for cerebral spinal fluid, an advanced neuroimaging protocol, and also use wearable sensors for 24/7 at home for 2 years. So it's a big protocol. The interesting thing is that patients are actually telling us that they want this protocol because they want answers to this horrible disease. And we strongly feel that a study like this, where you do multiple domains at the same time in the same patients and follow them for a long period of time, is really the way forward to get answers to new answers to Parkinson's disease. Am I worried it's not intense enough? I'm worried about two things. You need really large samples to get behind the reasons for variation between patients. So the main reason that we were interested in the study is, why does one patient do so different compared to another patient? So understanding variability between patients is the basis for precision medicine and being able to deliver a personalized approach tailored to that individual's personal needs. So we need a very large sample to get a feel for all the variations that are out there. Our project, the Personalized Parkinson Project, is well funded, yet we only have money for 650 patients. So my worry is that enough? Are we going to see enough variation in the data? And we currently have funding for 3 years of follow-up, whereas ideally I would like to do a long-term follow-up for 10, 20 years. But it's a wonderful start. Study's ongoing. First patients are in and doing well, tolerating the protocol. Our data are all to be shared, so scientists worldwide can have a crack at the data that are being collected at my university, because we strongly feel that data sharing is in the patient's interest. So I'm hopeful that we'll get answers. We are actively seeking additional funding to enlarge the cohort and to increase the follow-up.
Okay, well, I'm glad to see that it's at least taking root. I mean, I've long seen that something like that has been direly needed in the Parkinson's community, so I'm glad to see that at least somebody's taking the mantle and making it a reality. One aspect of it that I wanted to delve a little bit deeper into is the genetic aspect. And I saw that it was recently announced that a new artificial intelligence tool from Google called Deep Variant will also be used to help generate more accurate genome analysis. Can you talk a little bit more about how this will be integrated into the Personalized Parkinson's Project?
Yeah, so I think personalized medicine is very often equated with pharmacogenomics or genetics, and I think it's a big component. So we see patients, for example, in clinical practice who take rosagiline as an example, who respond excellently to rosagiline, and I have other patients who say it's like tap water. It's doing nothing. That has to be pharmacogenomics. So beginning to understand all the genetic determinants of the response to medication, for example, is going to really help in deciding which drug is best for which patient, and maybe which patient is more likely to experience a side effect than another patient. Yet at the same time, I also think personalized medicine requires more than just genetics. So personalized medicine is also preferable. Personalized medicine is whether you respond to visual cueing, looking at stripes on the floor, whereas other patients respond to auditory cueing. So the Personalized Parkinson Project is collecting everything, both genetics to get to the pharmacogenomic side, but it's also collecting the preferences of patients and their behavioral responses, so that ultimately you can base your personalized approach on really the whole collection of items that we're gathering in all these patients.
How do you envision that this project, if it goes through and it gets implemented on a wider scale, how will this actually change patients' visits to neurologists in the future, once neurologists have access to all this information?
You know, there are a great number of problems in healthcare right now. In fact, Ray Dorsey, a professor at Rochester, and a good friend of mine, and I published a paper in the Movement Disorders Journal. And when we submitted the paper, our opening sentence in the paper was, "We could not have designed healthcare worse." We asked patients with poor driving abilities to drive sometimes for hours, if you live in the United States, for example, to a hospital, to sit in a waiting room for a long time, to see your doctor for 15 minutes, if you're lucky, where we know patients perform paradoxically well. It's called kinesia paradoxa, and are not reflective of their behavior, you know, at home. So it's horrible. It's stupid. So I think when my dream is ready, patients will be able to track themselves at home, whether this be through self-monitoring with questionnaires or through wearable sensors or a combination. That information should be collected in a dashboard that's monitored both by the patient and a personalized case manager. And once patients begin to deviate from their projected path, then maybe a virtual home visit is needed. Not a visit to the hospital, but a virtual home visit. And if that virtual home visit is not enough, then a Parkinson's therapist comes to your home to see you in your own home environment. And if that fails, maybe you come to the hospital and see a neurologist. So that's a drastically different future that I think will allow us to give better care, because we can see patients in their own home. It reduces redundant care, patients coming to the hospital when it's not necessary. It reduces travel time, and I'm sure it leads to happier and healthier patients.
Well, I for one am really looking forward to that becoming a reality. The next question I wanted to ask was actually off of a quote that you said in an article from John Palfreyman. In it, you said that there are 5 million Parkinson's disease phenotypes, corresponding to the 5 million people worldwide with Parkinson's, each with their own individual profile. To follow up on that, do you also believe that we are going to need 5 million different therapeutic strategies to properly manage this disease?
Yeah, that's the consequence of that statement. So, you know, I remember making that statement, and I still believe that's true. Of course, you know, some patients may look relatively like another one, but ultimately, you know, I've dedicated my life to Parkinson's. That may sound dramatic. It isn't. I just feel very passionate about helping people with Parkinson's disease. And I've literally dedicated my whole research and clinical life to Parkinson's. the more patients I see, the more I'm convinced that there are no two people the same. They're just not the same. And whether this is genetics or preferences or the home they live in or the spouse they bring with them or the dog they care for, there are no two people the same. So in that regard, yes, 5 million patients deserve 5 million approaches.
Okay. Well, I hope somebody out there figures out a way to make that a reality, and it sounds like you're definitely leading the charge in that regard. The last question I wanted to ask was also based on one of the recent papers that you published, and that is your criticism of randomized control trials. What would you replace them with, and why do you have such like a deep-seated frustration with them?
Well, frustration is too big a word, I think. But I have concerns about clinical trials. The problem with the clinical trial is we tend to include the ideal patients between 40 and 65, no comorbidities and no other conditions other than Parkinson's disease, no cognitive impairments, living nearby the hospital, able and willing to complete questionnaires, whereas the folks that I see in everyday clinical practice have other conditions, are 83, have poor mobility, etc., etc. So the problem with the clinical trials is they are not fully reflective of daily life. Of course, they have advantages. I'm not saying we should get rid of randomized clinical trials. The advantage being that you carefully control for all sorts of conditions, for bias, etc. We're very excited that actually today, December 12th, we came out with a paper in The Lancet Neurology that was based on a medical claims database analysis. The interesting thing is that a medical claims database contains the data of every citizen, including the people with comorbid conditions, including the very old people, the very young ones, the unusual ones. Plus, the follow-up is much longer than a typical clinical trial. Our paper that came out in The Lancet Neurology today, just to give you an illustration, included 4,400 patients and data collected over 3 years. Our largest study until today included 600 patients and only 6 months of follow-up. So much larger study, plus it was a real-life representative population. And the data were very compelling. What we showed is that a specialized physiotherapist who works as part of the Dutch Parkinson Net is more effective. They require fewer treatment sessions. They lead to better outcomes, fewer hip fractures, fewer orthopedic injuries, fewer hospital admissions. They were cheaper, partially because they were more effective, fewer treatment sessions, but also because of the fewer complications. There was a tendency towards a 3% reduction in deaths, which I think is totally amazing. But it does make sense if you know that hip fractures, and in particular the consequences of the hip fractures, are one of the leading causes of death in Parkinson's disease. And the overall healthcare costs were also significantly down. So very exciting results, real-life observations. And it was a cheap study. You know, our biggest study so far was at least $1.5 million in dollars or pounds, if you want to see it. This was maybe $20,000-$30,000, you know, because all we had to do was analyze the existing data.
Okay, well, wow, that's a lot to unpack there. But yeah, it sounds like you're definitely paving a bold vision for the future for Parkinson's care. I just wanted to say thank you for all that you've done for the Parkinson's community, and on behalf of the, if I can speak on behalf of the patient community, I just want to say again, thank you for all that you've done to improve the standard of care for people with Parkinson's.
Ben, can I just add one thing, if I may?
Sure.
I did not answer one of your questions, which is, what if people are interested in having a Parkinson-net approach in their own area, city, country? For those people, I would recommend them to read the paper that we published in The Lancet Neurology, and also the one that came out in Health Affairs just a month ago. It shows that anybody interested in a Parkinson-net, and I'm speaking in particular about health insurers or national governments, should know that any investment made in Parkinson-net is easily outweighed by the cost savings for society. And we're very happy and keen to help out other countries in having a Parkinson net We now have international networks in California, in Norway, and Luxembourg is ongoing. So we have the experience, which was very positive in bringing the concept to another country. So I'm hoping that others will pick up the glove, as we say in Dutch, and also consider building networks in their country.
How do you say that in Dutch?
Pick up the glove.
Right. How would you actually say it in Dutch?
Ah, de handschoen oppakken.
Lovely language.
I told you it's a disease of the throat.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Bloom, for taking the time to speak with me today. I'm just going to turn off the recording now.